Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Dr. Carl, he's an Australian, a scientist, communicator, and popularizer. Very, very good morning. Welcome back. How are you?
Ahoy, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very, very much. Okay, of course, you spent your life not living in ignorance. Ignorance just not one of the options, I suppose.
Well, I read Plato's Republic when I was quite young.
Mm.
And I was surprised to read the phrase, the unexplored life is not worth living. And I suddenly realized that I had to look at everything and understand, why is the sky blue rather than green? Or why do things fall down rather than across?
Absolutely. Certainly I subscribe to that philosophy as well. But the one thing I've never understood is why women have colder skin than men. It isn't because they're cold-hearted, is it?
In fact, it's the exact opposite.
Oh, really?
And we know a bunch of things about women and their temperature, but we still haven't solved that problem. So definitely, women have higher core temperatures, you know, measured with a thermometer in the mouth or the ear or wherever. They have a higher core temperature, and it varies from person to person and day to day and so forth. And they're higher by about 0.2 or so of a centigrade degree, but they're... Oh, and by the way, when they're on birth control, they have even slightly higher core temperatures. But when you measure their skin, even though the core is warmer, the skin is colder, hands and feet, by about 1, maybe 1.5 degrees centigrade. And we're not really sure why. We know that they do have a slower metabolic rate than men. And so maybe to preserve heat energy, they have vasoconstriction, the blood vessels and the skin close down to make them feel cooler and trap their heat. But we don't know why, but we know it's real. But we do know one other thing, which is that air conditioning is sexist. Oh, my God, I'm sorry to say this, Dr. Howard.
What do you mean?
Air conditioning is around the world was set in 1966 via the American Society of Refrigeration and Air Conditioning Engineers on the famous Standard 55. And that basically used, as its reference point, a 40-year-old 70-kilogram male wearing a three-piece suit. So if you're talking about the offices back then, the women would be sitting towards the center of the room or the office or the floor with the cold air conditioning blasting down on them in their lighter clothing, while the males would be in their executive positions closer to the outside of the building, closer to the glass, wearing a three-piece suit and with crappy, rubbishy single glazing. So for the men to be comfortable, the women had to freeze. Another case of women being left out in the cold, I guess.
That's actually so interesting because I was always on the, because, you know, everybody fights about the air conditioning temperatures, whether you are in an office or a church or a synagogue, no matter where it is. Or at home, in our bedroom where my wife switches it off and I switch it on. And so it goes on and on and on. But I actually thought, interestingly, around the office, I thought it was just because women get colder than men do, but actually it's because it has been set at a lower temperature because of historical sexist issues.
On the other hand, now that we know about it, we can compensate for it. And so one day the women can be cold, the next day the men can be cold. We can take turn and turn about, have it fairly shared around.
That is so fascinating. Tell me about foreign accent syndrome.
It's a strange thing, which has happened to, since 1907, to about 150 cases in the medical literature, where a person wakes up and then suddenly that day and for quite a while have what appears to be a foreign accent. This can be related to some sort of brain disorder like a head injury or a stroke or even surgery. And it can be also related to diabetes or an immune reaction or mental illness or multiple sclerosis or some unknown cause. And the reason that it happens is that it's a disturbance with the fine motor control that we use to speak. So for you just to be able to speak clearly, you have to have very finely coordinated motor control by your brain over the muscles in your lungs and your larynx and your mouth and your tongue and your lips and your jaw. And as an example, I will now say the two words, moving my lips and not. So firstly, I'll do it being lazy and not moving my lips, and then I'll do it properly. British Constitution. British Constitution. You can see that unless you move your lips carefully, it just sort of slurs into British Constitution, which anybody who's had a drink of alcohol might know. So with regard to the foreign accent, it's simply a disturbance, and then the person listening says, oh, that's Welsh or Italian or Spanish or German. But when you then get somebody from their country to listen to it, they say, no, that's not an Irish or a French or a Welsh or Italian or Spanish or German or Chinese accent. That's just a mixture of things. And so it is, or can be, distressing, because speech is a large part of who you are and how you present yourself. And so you would speak differently, Dr. Howard, to a fellow professional in the media, or the nieces and nephews, or somebody you met at the beach, or the barista. Whereas with these people with the foreign accent syndrome, they have no choice. They have to speak the same way. And other people who are listening might think that they're mocking them. There's a whole bunch of things you can do. It's the treatment is a team response, speech pathologist, clinical psychologist, neurologist, neuropsychologist. And sometimes you might even need to go to acting school, where they'll teach you to speak with your original South African or Australian accent.
Absolutely fascinating. But we do that, don't we? We do change our register, our tone, our language as we encounter different people.
Yes, and it's part of who we are. But of course, we should be nice to everybody all the time.
Yep, there's a challenge. Give one more thing I wanted to cover with you is talking about the mass or the volume of the SARS-CoV-2 virus in the world. Because it's everywhere, isn't it? It's absolutely, well, except Australia. You guys have done very, very well in keeping it, you know, I think it's that whole border control. You know, we had that movie that used to keep me, that series that kept me up at night. Always watching people trying to sneak things into Australia. So you've managed to keep this virus pretty much out of the country. So you guys have done well, but the rest of us have suffered quite a bit from it. How much volume has SARS-CoV-2 taken up in the world?
Surprisingly little. You could fit it into probably a little can of soft drink, or maybe, but definitely into a 1 liter bottle of milk. So each person carries between them about 1 billion to 100 billion virus particles during their time of peak infection. And then you multiply that by the number of people who are currently infected at any given time and who are carrying the virus, and you come up with somewhere between 100 grams and 1,000 grams, which is a kilogram. There's different ways of measuring it, PCR and electron microscopy, and they sort of vary there. And surprising to think that something that fits into such a small volume with such a slow mass has changed the world in so many ways, besides the 160 or so million people infected and the 3.5 million people dead. We've also found the situation where in Las Vegas, the streets were so empty that the Canada geese would land in the street and waddle down the middle of the street. And dolphins were seen, and air pollution went down. And there were so many effects on the world from something so small.
And it fits into a tin of Coke. Really phenomenal. Roland giving us a very good idea. He says, I regularly bribe my female colleagues with Lindt chocolates. So they wear jackets and us guys get to send the air conditioning temperature. It works for everybody.
Chocolate is one of the sacred foods. Right. So the formula, in fact, chocolate was so beloved by Linnaeus, who is the god of botany, who a few centuries ago started naming things. He gave the active ingredient, or his followers gave the active ingredient in chocolate, a name relating to God. They called it theobromine. Theo as in theology, God, and bromine as in drink. So the active ingredient in chocolate, theobromine, is named after God. And if you have very wonderful chocolate, it'll melt on your tongue. And chocolate exists in 6 crystalline states. And it ranges from melting so beautifully on your tongue all the way down to the consistency of candle wax. And in yet another example of the law of maximum inconvenience, the one that the crystalline state of chocolate that is the most wonderful and delicious is also the most fragile and unstable.
Of course it would be.
Of course it would be.
Because that's how beauty works, except for diamonds. Dr. Cole, thank you.